So the Rav was very much aware, certainly teaching at Yeshiva University, of social changes in things that are part of Torah lore, let's say, obviously things like polygamy or maybe even the way children and parents relate to one another, or possibly even the way a Rebbe and a student relate to one another. Because of social structures, there's some things that Torah maybe begrudgingly allows that today we consider anathema and worthy of the ban. The Rav felt like the famous Tavla Meitav Tandu.
Right, that's what
The Rav was felt that's still operative today. Which basically, I know there are some women here, but basically says a woman would rather be married to a man rather than be alone. So, you know what I'm saying? But I think we might agree a bad marriage is worse than no marriage.
not
You think,
necessarily.
yeah, you see,
No, it's just
yeah,
simply, we
that's
know it's
what
not true.
yeah.
There are women who need marriage, got married.
Right, so. So what might be some of the sociological changes might be economic. A woman said, listen, I need someone to give me a child that'll bury me, because women typically, certainly in the Gemara's time, but throughout history, have been outliving their husbands.
That's still true.
I think it's the women's life expectancy is 5, 6, or 7 years higher than men in America. In some countries, it's even higher than that. So a woman wants to, I don't want to be alone. I want someone to take care of me. I don't want to starve. We have social security now. We have security nets so that a woman doesn't starve
Also, they have
when if her
monitored.
husband dies and she didn't have
They have
children.
pensions.
Yeah.
As well.
Okay, but anyway, that's what the ksuva was to protect. What the Howard was referring to is that what we hinted on last week was what the Rav described the conversation between Mordechai and Esther in the middle of the Megillah about the confrontation with Ahasuerus. Is that Mordechai approaches the problem the way a man would, given what he's supposed to do at the end of the Garden of Eden story. V'ze'at apecha tochalecha means, through the sweat of your brow, you and your family will eat. Now, we have to eat every day. So the man is busy worried about what if that I'm doing now, how does that impact on what's something that's going to happen 6, 8, 10 hours from now? Mordechai is acting as if though the decree is this afternoon, right? You have to do something now. Now, the conclusion of the woman's story in the Garden of Eden is that she has everything that has to do with raising a family, and that's down the line. That's at least 9 months. You don't have to come to a decision right now over which college this baby I'm pregnant with is going to go to. This is something we have time to talk about. Is it something to plan? Is it something that we have time to work? So Esther approaches the problem by saying, no, let's work this out. Let's come up with a, I'm gonna, I'm in the inside. I know my husband is paranoid. Let's work on a plan, right? Her plan tries to take advantage of Ahasuerus's paranoia. Now, how do we know he's paranoid? So that's what we did last week. And a little more, if you've been going to my Shabbos afternoon class, I showed you the chart of the 10 Persian kings. And when it says Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, who Achashverosh, it means that there's more than one. He's the Achashverosh who ruled over 127 provinces. And with the Tanakh evidence that Achashverosh in Sefer Daniel had a son named Daryavish, he appears in Sefer Ezra as the king who puts a stop to the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Not necessarily the temple, but the rebuilding of Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was not built in a day. It was built over time.
Is he Persian about this time?
The Darius is Persian. Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. Chazal say that this Darius's mother was Esther. Now, there was a king called Artaxerxes the first of four. Artaxerxes' count sounds a little like Ahasuerus, although it sounds more like Artaxasta in Nehemiah. Full disclosure: he had a father named Xerxes, right? And Xerxes sounds a lot like also Ahasuerus, and at the end he's called Chashrash, which sounds like it's trying to tell us who it is, right? Many scholars think he's Xerxes, but the Tanakh evidence seems to point to Artaxerxes, plus the fact that when Xerxes appointed Ahasuerus' brother as king first, but he never actually ruled. His name would have, I believe, have been another Xerxes, but this Artaxerxes, and the Gemara in Megillah says that Ahasuerus sheharag Esa'ach, he killed his brother to become king. So that, if Esther knows that, and probably everybody knows that, think of Hamlet and Macbeth. You know, when you kill a king, you're always looking over your shoulder that someone's going to kill you.
Richard II.
Yeah. So, whether or not you do a good job of, you know, of protecting yourself is a question. But he is paranoid. Plus, the Megillah manages to tell us there may have been more, but it does manage to tell us of an attempt on his life, and that the right person was at the right place at the right time to come up later in the story. Okay. So that also explains why originally, I remember, is anybody there in Shabbos? Some of you were there.
Yes.
I read I left it upstairs, but I read a description of Persian law from Herodotus. It reads like a satire.
Yes,
it could be, but it seems he's writing it to mock them.
Well, it makes sense.
Yeah, because he says that important rules of state in Persia are made at drinking parties, right? And they only come to a conclusion the next day after a drinking party, with someone who's sober throughout the whole party is taking down notes of their decision making, and they decide the next morning whether this decision made the night before is worthy of filing under law. So you see this idea about the difference between men and women and how they go about resolving the issue at hand is also coming up where the Rav said earlier in the story between Ahasuerus and Vashti. But it's more than just a Ralph Cramden kind of thing between men and women. It's an element of Persia versus Babylon. And Vashti represents the past. The Babylonian men were all killed off. The women were kept behind to Persianize. Your Babylonian approach is outdated. You may have been more cultured than we are, but we're better soldiers, so we won. So the Babylonians were very cultured. Science, art, music. Some of the ancient wonders of the world were Babylonian. So
the time for an hour, 60 minutes.
Yeah. So the Persians, the women who were left behind, remember the old times. They look at their boorish men, and they looked at them with contempt. So the Tanakh has its way of giving you these between the lines. Ahasuerus says, "Send Vashti Hamalka out to show her beauty." So the next pasuk says, "Batimain Hamalka Vashti." So that's the just like Chazal said. He goes, you don't know how to behave. You're not a king. Behaving like a boor, right? Like a stable hand. So getting rid of Vashti is not just showing who's boss in the household. It's that the Persian way has prevailed. Okay, so a little later in the story, you see that Esther takes advantage of her of what she knows as Ahasuerus's paranoia. I'll say more about that on Shabbos. What I'd like to now.
Why did you translate bringing a Sarah as cunning?
I think.
I think it's cunning. She's
more
just far
seeing. Yeah, I think maybe he's. I'll tell you what the Rav probably wrote a different word in Hebrew and someone translated that maybe.
Oh.
Because there is a word for cunning in the Torah that has a negative connotation in the Torah, but one book of Tanakh gave it a very positive connotation. The word is Orma. Right? The Nachashia Orum, they call it, you know the Hebrew word Orma, Laharim, mm-hmm. means to like to trick, to cheat. So Mishlei. Mishlei gives it a very positive spin. And Sefer Chassidim is, I mean, it's amazing. Yiras Hashem be'orma. You have to be cunning in your Yiras Hashem. You have to be cunning in order to to defeat the Yetzer Hara. You have to be cunning. You know, you have to go like Yaakov in the Gemara Megillah who told Rachel, I can be just as deceitful as your father. Right? It's a mitzvah. You know, is it permitted for you to deceive my father? He goes, it's a mitzvah. I can be his brother in deceit. Remember that Rashi brings
all the time. Translates Orma is
Chokhmah. Yeah, Baba Mirma. I think you mean Mirma.
Probably, yeah.
But it's probably etymologically connected. Reish Mem, like Ramai, Ramari, Sunny. Ayin and the Mem are rarely, but some prefixes that don't change the Iker meaning of the word. So Lavan Ha'arami, you know, is just a play on all of that stuff. So
that's what perspicacity is, in the sense that
that's I like that word better, yes.
Because you're saying I'm going to anticipate all the things that the are trying to do.
The whole Lavavcha, both your Lavavs. So that is, I think that, yes, that's so I think when the Rav wrote cunning, he might have been using that Mishleish kind of, and in Sefer Chassidim, I learned Sefer Chassidim with the Rav's son. You know, he's Rav Chaim, he's one of the great, great experts of Chassidi Ashkenaz.
It was great.
Yeah, it was in Revel. So I remember, you know, he told us the main buzzwords in Sefer Chassidim, and that's really one that he latches on to is Orma. You have to be clever and cunning. But here, I think here is where it comes from, is that women, maybe for the same reason we just described, you don't have to be cunning to get those weeds to stop killing your seeds. You have to be cunning cunning is something down the line. It's something you plan for a long way down the line.
Actually, you do, because you worry about, you know, like, is this going to cause damage to other crops?
Yes, okay, in the chinami. But I wouldn't call that cunning. I would call
that...
No,
it's not. That's why it's not. Yeah.
So the amazing way Chazal have, you know, like the way the Rav approaches these things, it is philological, because when God creates man, it says Vayas, God made man. But God uses a different verb when he creates woman, which is
Vayitzer?
No. You think you just said
Vayitzer?
No, close. Vayiven. Vayiven. So he built. So the Gemara makes a few drushes on that. One is that woman had to be built differently to Makabel the Vlad. Right, to Makabala the baby. But Vayiven also has in it the terminology for Bina.
Right? I think it's more formidable, stronger, withstand more.
Yeah, good. So, but they're really different words. Bina is the yud in it, which is Bain. Bain means to differentiate between A and B, which is typical of cognitive levels of thinking. The man has to have knowledge and information. And the woman has to go to the next level, which is comprehension, which is lahavin bein davar ledavar, right? So the Gemara admits that she has an intuitive knowledge or intuitive understanding that man gets from you know, sitting and learning Ibayas to Rabba Babaya, you know, and things like that. But the woman has an intuitive understanding of that by the way she is built, so to say, the Bina. Okay, all right, fair enough. And that could be the cunning, you know, the word that the Rabb used for that, because it involves thinking down the line. Okay, now I want to take a totally different direction, which is the Rav's discussion of the Purim commitment that was made by Klal Yisrael. That commitment is one of the proofs the Gemara gives that the book has prophecy in it. Because how could the author know Kimu B'Kiblu? They were Mekayim and they were Mekabel. What does that mean? Right, so the Gemara Darshan's Kimu Mashakiblu Kvar. They accepted what they had once before said Naaseh V'Nishma and Har Sinai. So now they are unequivocally. So that's a famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, that our commitment to accepting the Torah had an excuse at Mamad Har Sinai. Yes. Now it is midrashically manifest in a mountain held over our heads. You familiar with midrash like that?
And the Makos, yeah.
And the Makos they had seen, that's the Bechor Shor's explanation, a deeper explanation of that, is that the mountain held over their head is indeed the Kriyas Yamsuf, the Makos, the Tzion in general, is that they were coerced, as it were, to receive the Torah without making a measured, judgmental determination that this is the right thing for us. And in saying Naaseh V'Nishma, in other words, committing to performing this before we even knew what was in it. Remember, the Goyim asked nations of the world who were offered the Torah also asked, what's in it? And when they learned that what's in it was antithetical to their way of lives, they rejected it. Right? So the Rav pointed to a Tosefta in Bava Kamma. Did you get that? The Rav pointed to a Tosefta in Bava Kamma that says that Naaseh V'Nishma was Gneivas Das. We jumped the gun. Right? We made a commitment. We obviously weren't ready to. Right? How do I know? I can read a Rashi. There's a Rashi at the end of the Torah. In Parshas Ha'azinu. So it says, Dor lo emun bum. A generation of people without emunah.
I mean, did they really have a choice? Like Naaseh V'Nishma, I mean,
so the answer,
given what they experienced before getting the Torah.
That is exactly, I think you're asking a fair question, and the answer is no. They did not have a choice, because when you have a mountain held over your head, of course you're going to take it. Now, the mountain was never held over your head. It's as if though a mountain was held over you and said, okay, I'll accept, or if I don't accept, I'm going to get buried. 3 million of us are going to get buried under this mountain. So it just means that they were so just taken aback by all the events of the time.
Is
what I'm sorry?
A double conversion.
I mean, meant it's so yes, exactly. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There was a double conversion. That's not a great statement. The first conversion was at Har Sinai. When's the second?
Yeah, Purim.
Okay, Kimu V'Kiblu. So that's why the Gemara says that they are bound to the Torah, not by what happened at Har Sinai, because there was coercion at that time. They're bound to the Torah by the Purim story, because there, as Aliza just said, there was no coercion. It was Kadosh Baruch Hu was hidden. So there's a medrash that says, and the Rav always he likes to cite this because it was so. Listen to the drash he gives: Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira. So much hinges on what that means, especially since the Rav was very much familiar with the Haskalas. You ever hear the Haskalas? Be an ish in your home.
No, be ish in the street.
In the street, and a Jew in your home. Right? And he was right. Be a Jew in your home. Wear your tefillin at home. Wear, you know, or maybe in shul, fine. But you don't have to show any Jewish manifestation of your existence, you know, as you're out in the street, because you need to be accepted out there, and they're not going to accept you as a Jew. So be a Jew in your home. Do you know, do you ever hear the exact Lashon? Yehudi b'vei secha, b'ish b'tzei secha, something like that.
They get it from that pasuk.
No, but it's a repudiation of that.
No, Yehudi
ayah b'shushan habira. You could be a Jew in Shushan Abira, but of course the Hamans of the world are not going to be happy with that. So the Haskalah. Look, what can I say of it? Maybe it was just ahead of its time, but all of Mendelssohn's children and most of his students converted to Christianity. So I'm not finding Kidor Lo Emun Bam, but Rashi on that pasuk says this is an untrustworthy generation, because they said Naseh v'nishma u'b'sha'a kala. What'd they do? Made an ego. So, easy come, easy go. You went so quickly to say Naseh v'nishma, and then at the first sign of any problem, that's it, finished, goodbye.
Well, it could also be saying you learn it based on you see when it flows only.
Yeah.
It's built on sand.
The Rambam was very, very much big on that, especially with Christianity, teaching all the miracles and things like that. We don't believe in Moshe because of miracles. We believe in it because of the truth of his mission. So this is the...
But, the Rambam is certainly inconsistent, because in the semester we talked about the contrast, being well, we should be childlike, exuberant. And in Isha Lecha, he talks about there, all of them had this prior, almost childlike emuna, and which preceded their faith, and why he thought he didn't think they were capable of cultivating that with the students and the students. So they had arguments. It's more Kagardian than James.
Maybe he just, Metzias he saw before him required.
Mm-hmm.
For a different approach, maybe. Okay, let's I'll just close with this dichotomy, because there's a whole different derech I'd like to move to, which is there's a medrash that says that although the Jews did descend into levels of tumah, but there are some outward things that they did not change. Right? They didn't change their dress, change their names, right? They didn't change their language. So there's things that they maintained that kept them moored to a certain derech. Then, but in Persia, the assimilation was so profound. They enjoyed the meal of Ahasuerus, and they became more Persian than Persian. So this is the dichotomy in the Midrash. You were kept your Judaism hidden, so I'm going to be hidden in this story. In Egypt, they kept, they still maintained their names and their dress and their distinction, and the Egyptians weren't going to let them assimilate. Although it does say Vatimalei Haaretz of some, which implies that they left Goshen and they disseminated. But they kept their outward manifestations of the Jewishness. So Hashem says, okay, you will see me an outward manifestation. There were profound miracles. One may argue, as I show in my Haggadah, to the cynical child, it's my opportunity to, cynical child wants to know, tell me about the 10 plagues. How do I know that they happened? So the plagues were indeed manifest in ways where a non-believer could doubt.
Right.
Yeah, the blood, the wasn't real blood, or maybe there were crocodiles, and the crocodiles ate up a lot of fish, and the fish, the blood ran, and the blood made the frogs run out, and then the frogs brought lice, and then the lice brought the arov, and the arov brought the dever, and the dever brought the shin. It's only with the hail Now, hail can fall so with such intensity, maybe that it would, but that's when power really started to relent. But you see that the plagues were given to power in a way where if you want to doubt, you'll doubt. Right? Moshe did not take a staff and point it at the sun and say, "Watch, power, and slowly bring the sun into the water," or grab it into his hand and say, "There's the sun right there," and then throw it back in the sky. Then Paro would let them out that day. Then Paro wouldn't have had free will, because he would have let them out against his will. Right? Hashem had to give him the plagues and kibayochel harden his heart so that when it was time to let them go, yes, get out of here, and willingly. I just told you it was this morning in his introduction to the 10 plagues. So that's the dichotomy between Purim and Yetzias Mitzrayim. One additional dichotomy I'd like to mention is a very famous line, but it's so, Howard, you told me you read it in the Reflections of the Rav. It is just so perfectly designed to take from it's a Maimar Chazal that says Yom Kippurim is a Yom Kippurim. Right? And Yom Kippur is a day like Purim. Now, come on. How can you say such a thing? One is fasting, one is feasting. One is drinking till you don't know the difference between, you know, and one is not drinking anything. How can Yom Kippur, where I'm clapping and clapping and I'm Purim, where is any manifestation of the same behavior? So the Rav started off by saying the name of the holiday. Right, he peeled poor who hagoral. Right, this is where I think where we ended last week, is that what is it about the fact that Haman took one hat with 30 days in it, one hat with 12 months in it, and he pulled out another 13, other 13. That's the day I'll kill the Jews. That should name the holiday, right? He peeled poor who hagoral. Yimei HaPurim Ha'ela. Pur is it means a lottery in Persian. Right? So the festival of lots. Where are you going for your lots dinner this year? Where are you going for your lots seuda?
I realized Puraya in Aramaic is just multiple Pur. It's the plural Pur.
Yes, yes. Now, it seems that some Achronim learned Pshat in the Rambam where he writes, you should drink just enough to calmly go to sleep and take a nap. Furaya is also a bed in Aramaic.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's a bed?
A puraya is a bed in Aramaic. Yeah. So maybe it means chayavinish. So when you go to lie down and go to sleep, you're not going to know between eye. You know? It just so happens, amazingly, I'm sure the Gemara knew this, that the gematria of Oru Haman is exactly, not one even one off, it's exactly the same as Baruch Mordechai. So what it means is you're so drunk that you can't figure out that gematria in your head. I have a book at home with 127 different interpretations of that maimer. Anyway, that's a start. That's a start because a goral, a lottery, is a main focus of the Yom Kippur ritual. Right? There's a lot going on Yom Kippur. But the star of the show is the choice of two goats, where one gets sent out into the desert with all the sins of Israel to Azazel. Right? And one remains here and is holy unto God. So what determines the difference between this this practically exact opposite... exact opposite destiny, kibayachol. So this must the Rav said, this must have had a profound effect on the people watching this, which is, Ribono Shalom, what a piece of work is man. What a small little difference. I can tell you so many stories, just a slight inch over there, way further. Life is so precarious. Right now, so much different. You know, you know, they make the train, you hit the ball, you know, I don't know, you have all these you know, what if kind of things, but so the first thing the Rav says it should make us is humble. The Rav said that practically all these things we do on Yom Kippur, deep down, what they all have in common is stealing something that's not yours because you think that it's coming to you. And that's arrogance. If you look at the Gemara in Sota about the 11 villains, right, who, what makes you a villain is that you think that that more than you deserve is coming to you, and you won't stop at anything to get it. Right? Now, if I want to get more than I deserve, someday work harder, get a higher degree, you know, work, you know, make yourself worthy. You can do that. Maybe the Netziv wasn't worthy to be a Rosh Yeshiva, but he worked so hard at it. He became such a Sar HaTorah by committing to it from such a young age that he became so great.
That's already a foreign idea, because perhaps someone who really thinks they're not getting what they deserve would never think of that.
In a Hanami, but would make someone a villain, starting with the snake, is to want something that's you know, listen, who am I to say what someone shouldn't want, but it's something where you have to know yourself. And the Rav said that it's there's good reason why the Rambam said that practically everything in your life you should be in the middle of the road, but when it comes to arrogance, knock it down, beat it down, you know.
You know, that was actually on the court of the Hitler's personality, but he was convinced he was this great artist and nobody else. He kept getting rejected from the art institute in Vienna, and it was that resentment that he wasn't being recognized for what he was. So it's actually perfectly consistent with being that villain.
It's a little like Korach. Yeah. Chazal say that Korach, what it was, that he wasn't accepted as the head of his tribe, so mm-hmm. he made it a whole big, much bigger thing. That he was to Eli Tzafan, what? No, that Korach just, it was personal first, and then he built it into something bigger. So that's the definition of villainy. So we are meant to be exposed to our own potential villainy on Yom Kippur, and we say, no, I'm going to take charge. The Azazel is going to get his piece. And he's going to get his goat and answer, right? And I'm going to fix myself. And Rav said that must have had a great influence on the people seeing this. And even I don't know if this was in the article, but the fact that it's a goat of all animals, the Sirizim Echod L'Chatos, the goat is what the brothers used to trick Yaakov into thinking that Yosef was dead. And in turn, Yaakov used two goats when he obeyed his mother to get the bracha. That was Esau's. Not one, but two goats. Right? So
tomorrow,
yes, yes. Wow, it's a big day for you. No goodness, it's great. That's great. Yes, it seems that Yehuda is in on it too. And the Rambam writes in the Moreh Nevuchim that that's why the sin offering throughout Parshas Pinchas is always the goat, right? So it's a reminder of what, it's not the lamb. The lamb reminds of the rams, but the lamb reminds us of Yitzchak. That's a whole different thing. But the goat is and then you take the I think it's such a beautiful wrapping of the rub. It's like a little. What do you call that thing you put on the top of wrapping paper, like a little flower, a bow, right? So it's like a bow on top of the Rav's, Rav's amazing Torah, is that the English word to describe this, Rav may use it, maybe, I'm not sure, but capriciousness, did he use that word there, Howard? Did you remember seeing it? The capriciousness of life.
Right. That's what you're talking about.
It means that the vicissitudes and the twists and turns of life, that this, he did mention, that's captured by this amazing pasuk in Koheles that says, I'll paraphrase, that our lives are like a bird in a fish. The animals we don't see because they're in the water, right? Like a bird and a fish caught in a net. Remember that?
Yeah,
so because they're just it comes suddenly. That's the main word, is that it's sudden. Gam lo yedaha adam es ito kadogim shene achozim b'mitzodora ah v'chatzi parim ha'achuzos b'pach kohem yukashim b'nei ha'adam la'isra akashit bol aleihem pit'om. Pit'om means that pit'om is such a frailness of ours. So that pit'om means that, like October 7th was so pit'om. Like, you know, you knew before the Six-Day War, things were getting very precarious for a long time, and Israel was not sure. This just smacked us right between the eyes, and you know, everything is going great, and you're having such a wonderful.
No, that's actually a huge question.
Thank you.
You know, those women picked up all this stuff.
Thank you.
And they,
right.
And you know, so there's a lot of
psychological abuse too.
Yeah.
And there's it was mine from the Jewish intelligence. So we don't know.
Yeah, I see the commissions. But the pitomiut of life, where you know, the things you can read about, look, it's a lot of people in the world, so you know, there's going to be a lot of random stuff going on. But the story is such. I don't know where do you begin, because you hear stories in your family. This is what happened here. This happened there, and so the capriciousness of life is so debilitating. So, but. Now, circle back to what Howard said before. But you know what I have every day? I have Shemon Esrei. I have the Amida. I talk to God every day. Someone's listening. I can pick up the phone. So the Rav quoted this. It's such a beautiful Gemara. It's in the fifth parak in Brachas. It tells a parable. A poor man is starving. And he sees the king's officials enjoying a feast on his lawn. And he goes up to the gate and just lovingly, longingly looks at them and says, Chevra, please can you spare some of that food? No one even looks at him. What's the next line in the Gemara? So he goes up to the king's table and says, Your Majesty, can you share some of your food with me? And he says, Sure, here, take some. What kind of nonsense is this Gemara? The king's attendants don't let you in from the fence. How did he get into the king's chambers?
It's the
king. Yeah, so how did he get into the king's chambers?
He just wanted
Ezra. He started Dan Shmuel Ezra. Took 3 steps back. Right? And he got right up to talk to the king. No, intermediaries is let me ask the governor. Maybe he'll give me, maybe I'll ask the. So Hashem, we're supposed to be the intermediaries to look at people who need help and you know, help that person. Right? So when it says that Hashem loves the orphan and the widow, really? And why did you take their father? Why did you take their husband? I didn't take him. That's part of a large picture. But the way I show that I love the orphan and the widow is to convince everybody else who reads Torah that you've got to look after the orphan and the widow. That's how I love them. And I expect it of them. Right? And the Torah speaks very harshly to those who don't take care of orphans and widows. Remember? Mita keneged mita. Mita. You don't take care of orphans and widows, you know who's going to become a widow? Right? Your wife. So the Shemona Esrei becomes this great. It's like a Yom Kippur. Is that it demonstrates every time I take 3 steps back, I'm standing at the Mizbeach on Yom Kippur, watching these two goats. This goat that's Kadosh Lashem. That's what I think I am right now. I'm feeling riding high. I had a great day today. And then the other goat is. But you know what? I have, you know, I go about my business. I'm going into a car. Every time you do something, there's a certain percentage. You know, what? Do safe things. Don't do stupid things. But even if you do everything the right way by the book, sometimes you know, it's tzadik v'ra'al or rush of a tovlo. You never know. That's why the Torah speaks in its like almost like a guarantee for what's going to happen in reward and punishment. So I would like to close today's shiur with the following. And the ending of the story of Purim is just such a prescient message of this kind, is that when the Torah tells us the rewards for obeying and the punishments for disobeying, those are not punishments or rewards, those are consequences. And it's not what will happen, it's what ought to happen. And when you tell your child what's going to happen if you run out into the street when the right light is red, you run out into a busy street, what's going to happen? Tell it the way you'd say it.
Is life happen?
I wouldn't say that. But I would say you run out into the street, you're going to get hit by a car. You think I want that?
No.
I think if I see from the window my child running out into the street, I'm gonna hope, oh, good, there's a car coming. Maybe I'll get hit. Of course not. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want any of those things to happen to us. This is like I was kasher sasti. No, chas v'shalom. It's just these are anthropopathisms. Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want any of those things to happen. I don't think Hashem ever punished us. There's not punishments. Nothing in the Tochacha is a punishment any more than cancer is a punishment for smoking. Those are consequences. Those are things waiting to happen to you if you turn away from the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. Not because I want them to happen, right? So that the Purim story shows us this profound capriciousness of life, the Nahafohu. In the beginning of the story, he lets his friend convince him to kill his wife. And at the end of the story, the dichotomy has his wife convincing him to kill his best friend.
Wow. I didn't think about that.
So it's, and it's for Nahafohu. Everything gets on its head. So I have this amazing sefer at home. But it's long. The sefer is long. It's not like 1,000 words. It's a sefer. I don't know who had time. I hope they did it with a computer. The entire book is a palindrome. You know what I'm saying? No, hundreds, maybe even thousands of words. But how does this person do this? The entire book comes down to the middle.
It's comprehensible?
Yeah.
Wow.
In Hebrew. In Hebrew.
Wow. That's some of that.
Divrei Torah on Purim.
That's
amazing. So, but you get it. It's Benapo. So I gave a test this past week, a midterm, and I said, there's 5 extra points if you can explain why did I give the test this way. And it took one guy got it. It was a test with 25 questions. It was 25 answers, and they had to write the question. It was a test on Megillas Esther, and I gave the answers, and they had to come up with a question that fit that answer.
Oh, that's nice.
So is that easier? That's probably easier, no? Anyway, that's what I did. So the book is a big Nahafohu. And Yom Kippur is hopefully that's what Yom Kippur is. Yom Kippur is the biggest Nahafohu. Is that Kodesh Baruch Hu is going from the Kisei Din to the Kisei Rachamim. What could be a bigger Nahafohu than that for me? You know, I admit I messed up this year, but I'm committing that this year will be better. In even in one way, but I'm going to work harder this year. I may be here next year saying all the same things, but I'm trying to Nahafohu. And what could be the better example of Yom Kippurim as a Yom Kippurim? And then you even have the Goral of the Yonah story. I think that has to fit in there also. And then maybe we'll do that next Yom Kippur. But this is really the Rav put this together so amazingly using the Pasuk in Koheles as like a linchpin, the Pitomiyut of Purim. Such a Pitomiyut story, right? Now just, it's like Deus Ex Machina, how things turn around with Haman on his way to try to get this guy hanged. And then just like on a dime, everything, because he couldn't fall asleep and he was there, and everything fits in so beautifully. It's almost a little like Yosef, but you see that's the Pitomiyut of life, and you know, you have to keep hoping that even just the Nafohu, that we have this. You all know what Deus Ex Machina is in the Greek theater. They would get things like it's so, oh my God, look at this, it's crazy. This that and all of a sudden in one fell swoop, something, and that the word machine comes from that. This Machina would come in and fix it all and make the play end in a good way. And one by one, everything falls away.
Machina.
Very clever, very clever, very clever. Yeah. So never heard the terminology before. So it's sort of like in some Disney films also, like The Wicked Witch or the Yeah, but they always end just so suddenly, just like, but life isn't like that. It could be dangerous if you think that that's right. You have a dream, a wish, and a star. Yeah, but okay, but to some extent, it's there is something here that that's moving in the same direction. Okay, so
Rabbi has one point that if because of the consciousness, and it's going to lead to ethical sensitivity because
absolutely
this could easily be you,
right? Ethical sensitivity and so much so humility.
But now we're dealing for two. You could not be
so clear over how close we are, therefore, the grace of God to such a bad situation. Okay, I'm going to take it from a very different direction on Shabbos afternoon, more textual. So if you want to hear more, and then but next week already we're doing Shira Shira.
Oh, wow.
Because it's already been
postponed.
Next Monday night.
So we should be doing Purim on next week.
I mean,
Monday.
Monday we're going to do Shira Shira already. Shabbos is still Purim.
Oh, so Shabbos. So we're doing Shira Shira.
Monday night. I want to do a little Shira, and with the Rav called the Vida Fake. Yeah. This is a Rav Shira after all.
No, right?
Yeah.
I hope you will.
You've read Kol Vida Fake, of course.
Of course.
Okay. Well, of course, we'll have to do Shira Shira and Perek Hey, we'll discuss it. Okay, everybody know what I'm talking about? Okay.
Shira, of course. Yeah.
Sure, of course.
So, tries to make the rabbi into a yoga.
So, come by, everybody.
Call your package and figure it out.